Hi everyone, and welcome to one more episode of the All Plane Podcast, where we talk with the movers and shakers that are redefining the future of commercial aviation. As usual, before we start, I would like to remind you that all previous episodes of this podcast, as well as many other aviation stories, are available on the All Plane website at allplane.tv, allplane.tv. There on the website, you will also find a link to subscribe to the All Plane newsletter, which I highly recommend. It's a newsletter that I send pretty much every week with the most relevant news and stories about aviation, sustainability, and innovation. Today, we welcome to the pod Dr. Klaus Rademacher, an engineer and consultant with a professional background in the technology industry. Dr. Rademacher is an expert in what in management circles is commonly known as business excellence. And in the last few years, he's been increasingly interested in the topic of mobility and transportation from a sustainability perspective. This is how Dr. Rademacher started applying his analytical framework to some of the most pressing issues that the aviation industry, and in fact the broader transportation industry, face right now. In particular, Dr. Rademacher has been looking at the relative environmental impact and the energy efficiency of different modes of transportation, such as the plane, the train, and the car. Why is this relevant? Well, because right now, particularly in Europe, lots of policies are being formulated on the assumption that the train is often a superior mode of transportation from an environmental perspective. So Dr. Rademacher has crunched the numbers, spent a considerable amount of time analyzing them, and has come to a conclusion that may come as a shock to many, and that is that we are calculating everything wrong. Yes, I'm aware that this might be a controversial point of view and that many listeners might not agree with this, but, well, this is a complex debate, and I think that the issues at hand are important enough that they should be approached with an open mind. This was actually a very long conversation, and we ended it with the feeling that we had just scratched the surface. In any case, I think it's best if we listen to Dr. Rademacher explaining his assumptions, his calculations, and his findings directly. So without further ado, let me welcome him to the podcast. Hello, Klaus. How are you?
I'm fine, Michael. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for making time today for this conversation. I came across your work a few weeks ago at the European Regional Airline Association meeting in Berlin, where you delivered a presentation that I think got everyone very intrigued, including many seasoned professionals and executives that were there, because you have a view about the, let's say, the issue of aviation emissions and decarbonization of the aviation industry that, I don't know if I should call it contrarian, but I'm sure it's going to generate some thought. But first of all, I just would like to introduce you briefly. You are Dr. Klaus Rademacher. You have a background in computer science and business, particularly in business excellence. And it's through this consulting practice that you got interested in traffic and mobility systems, looking into aviation and comparing aviation to other modes of transportation, looking at what you say is the wrong way to look at things, and you have developed another model to think about this topic, about which mode of transportation is more, let's say, sustainable, or how to approach the sustainability of different modes of transportation. So I'll let you first explain this in your own words, because I think it would be interesting to learn a bit more about your background, and then we can maybe move on to discuss this work that you've done in the field of aviation sustainability.
Yeah, thank you, Michael. Thank you for having me as a guest in this podcast. I'm very happy to be here. And you already introduced me in an almost perfect way. That is exactly what I did over the last years. I've been looking at mobility. Let's put it like that, at mobility and mobility systems from a more holistic view. And the important thing is to look at the systems that are required in order to provide any form of mobility, any form of transportation, no matter whether we transport people or whether we transport goods or freight. In the public and in the political discussion, carbon dioxide, CO2, is generally known, and that is absolutely correct, as hazardous for our climate because it has a warming effect in the atmosphere. But what we've been looking at too much is the carbon dioxide that comes from the exhaust gases of vehicles. And what we have not been looking at are the huge amounts of carbon dioxide originating from the infrastructure around the different systems which are absolutely required and necessary in order to provide any transportation.
If I may stop you here 1 second, what you do is you look at all the different modes of transportation in a holistic way, because often in this debate, you get people pitching one type of transportation against another as if they were happening in isolation. But in reality, what you're saying is we should be comparing the whole investment that is necessary to have a fully functioning transportation system, because
Absolutely.
you cannot just check going from point A to point B and check, let's say, the environmental impact of your journey, but everything that needs to happen so that you can go from point A to point B with mode of transportation X or mode of transportation Y or Z. And you had this kind of controversial statement at the conference saying, like, we are calculating everything wrong. Well, not everything, but we're calculating things wrong, yeah? So, and
Absolutely.
you've got a solid engineering background here, and we had a conversation about this, and you provided me with numbers, calculations that you've done on specific cases. Can you tell us more about this? I mean, how you view this topic?
Yes, I'll try to get a little bit more specific ideas on this. When we go up on a, let's say, 10,000 feet bird's view of transportation or mobility, we easily see there are four basic transport or mobility systems, which are the railway systems, the roads, aviation, and shipping. So everything that deals with mobility is using either one of these systems. And for each and every one of these systems, we need to have vehicles with which the transportation takes place. So that's either trains or cars, trucks, it's aircraft or ships. And then for every one of the systems, the vehicle need to be driven by some kind of energy. So that is electricity or diesel in the case of trains. It's gasoline, diesel, or lately also electricity for cars. It is kerosene, aviation fuel for aircraft, and it's heavy oil, marine diesel, or liquefied natural gas for shipping. Then, in addition to that, each of these four systems requires its own very specific and completely incompatible infrastructure. And that is a real thing we have to look into in more detail, and that is almost everywhere in the discussions. More or less neglected. Every system has its own node infrastructure, as I call it. The node infrastructure is in every transportation process the beginning and the end of a transportation process. So, when we go by a train, it's the node infrastructure are the train stations. For aviation, it's the airports. For shipping, it's the harbors. And going by car, it's the parking space. It's a garage, it's a parking space in the street, it's the driveway. And every transportation starts and ends at a place of the node infrastructure. Then, secondly, we need the path infrastructure, and that is what connects the different nodes. So, for aviation, that's the very important part. The path infrastructure is the air. The air between two airports, and the air is just there. For shipping, the path infrastructure is, at least in international seaways, it's the oceans. So if you go from Hamburg to New York, you just go across the Atlantic Ocean, and that's it. And it's there. Now, when we have the two land-based transport or mobility systems, which are railway and road, the path infrastructure needs to be built. It's streets, including bridges, sometimes tunnels. It's railroad tracks, the electrification on the tracks, and so on and so on. So that is very, very carbon intense. And I will explain that later why this is the case. And then there is a third important infrastructure aspect that needs to be taken care of, and that has to be built specifically for each and every mode of transportation. That is what I call control infrastructure. Control infrastructure is required and necessary if there are several participants in the same system providing transportation at the same time, simultaneously. For example, in the railway systems, it's signal boxes, signals, and switches. That's their control infrastructure. For road traffic, it's traffic lights, traffic signs, traffic rules. For aviation, it's everything that has to do with ATC, the air traffic control facilities. And for shipping, we have lighthouses, radio beacons, pilots, and so on and so on. So my perception is that we have to look at each of all of these components when we want to analyze the carbon footprint or the ecological footprint in a broader sense for the transportation systems. And currently, this is not happening because we're always looking or we're focusing far too much on the drive energy. That is the energy that moves the vehicle that we sit in when we are going from A to B.
Yeah, but for example, when it comes to electric cars, comparing just moving away a bit from aviation or wind turbines, I see people saying, well, you should also take into account all these construction materials. So there is some people mentioning that impact. You think that is not happening enough when it comes to mass transportation?
That was a very good example, Mikhail, that you just made. Electric cars. People are so fond of their electric cars. When it comes to looking at the vehicle, we have to do that. The vehicles are trains, aircraft, ships, or cars. When we're looking at the individual vehicles being built, then we have to look at what is the overall transportation volume of a single vehicle. And the transportation volume we measure, if we're talking about moving people, if we're talking about transporting people, the currency that we're talking about is PKM, person kilometer. That is transporting one person over a distance of 1 kilometer. And that's always a multiplication. So a plane with 300 people that goes from, let's say, somewhere in Central Europe to New York, it's 5,000 kilometers. So that plane offers 300 times 5,000 kilometers on that very single flight as a transportation volume. So that's what we have to look at. Now, speaking of cars and analyzing the traffic performance or the transportation performance of individual cars used and owned by individuals, that is extremely low. So in most European countries, we have a performance of only 160,000 kilometers in the lifetime of a car. And while a car is being driven, it is only occupied on average by 1.5 people, which means an individual car owned by a person has an average transport volume of 240,000 person kilometers, which is very low compared to the carbon footprint that already exists from the production of the car, which is for average cars around 8 tons, 8,000 kilograms of carbon dioxide. And if we have a battery-powered electric car, the production of the battery is very, very CO2 intense as well. We're talking of, depending on the size of the battery, but we can add a single-digit number of tons of CO2 for the battery as well.
But some people might tell you, well, yeah, but we are not comparing the car, the electric car, compared to nothing, to just traveling by horse or something like that. But we're comparing it with other vehicles as well that also have their footprint and over the lifetime. That I guess then it depends on how many kilometers, how much fuel are you burning through this lifetime of the car.
That is the drive energy that we use. Yes. And but once again, for a car, let's stay at the example with a car, and then we should go back to aviation because I think most listeners in this podcast are more keen about to or keen to learn more about aviation. But in a car, the average fuel consumption results in about 85 grams of carbon dioxide per person kilometer from drive energy. It's 85 grams. That's the average you use. And if we look at the amount of carbon dioxide that was already emitted to manufacture the car, and then divide that, the 8 tons, if we divide that by the 240,000 PKM, person kilometers of lifetime performance, traffic performance of that car, we have to add 33 grams for each person kilometer of transportation. And so that's more than a third of what comes out of the exhaust gas, the exhaust pipe. And that is a lot. That is much, much lower. It's much lower. The carbon footprint of the production of the vehicle is much lower for a train or even for an aircraft. Because in trains, if we use them for like 25 years, we see traffic volumes of, well, let's say about 3 billion person kilometers for an average utilized train, for example, in Germany, over 25 years. With aircraft, we see double-digit billion person kilometer numbers over a time frame of 25 years. In extreme cases, I've analyzed that for a very specific plane by looking at the average utilization rate and by looking at how much a plane flies during 1 week. And I picked an extreme example. I want to make that very clear. This is not average, but it's an extreme example, and it clearly shows what planes are capable of doing. I looked at an Airbus A380 from Emirates, and they have the largest A380 fleet, and I'm fully aware that A380 is not the most fuel-efficient plane these days. There are much better ones. But anyway, looking at a single plane, what it flies during a week, and the average utilization, the seat, the load factor in the seats, almost 80%. And if you then calculate these numbers and think about 25 years of service for such a plane, you reach more than 40 billion person kilometers just from that single plane. And that is a much, much higher number compared to the manufacturing of the plane and the carbon footprint that was emitted during the manufacture. I'm fully aware that, of course, a plane needs maintenance and a train needs maintenance, but also cars need maintenance. And all that has a certain CO2 footprint, but we still can see that the better an individual vehicle is being utilized and the higher the traffic performance is, the more ecological it is when it comes to what is the carbon footprint compared to its transport volume.
One question, and the yeah. numbers for cars, the mm-hmm. average numbers that you mentioned, are they mm-hmm. from Germany? Where are they yeah. from?
Well, the average numbers of 8 tons per vehicle from the manufacturing, that is a study or a survey that had been conducted several years ago already by the German Motor Vehicle Association, ADAC, with an eco-institute in Heidelberg in Germany. Unfortunately, we have to say the number is today rather larger than smaller because cars tend to be getting heavier and heavier and more luxurious. And with regard to the batteries, there is a Swedish study that has been published a little while ago that came up with the numbers that per kilowatt hour of for the battery. So you have to look at each kilowatt hour. So if the battery has like 50 kilowatt hours, these numbers have to be multiplied by 50. We are in the range of about 60 kilograms of carbon dioxide per kilowatt hour for a battery in a car. And so if you have a 100 kilowatt hour battery, which is a battery like for a large Tesla car, we're talking an additional roughly 6 tons of carbon dioxide just from the production of the battery. With regard to the utilization, 1.5 on average, that are the German numbers, but they are very similar to many, at least Central European countries. It's the same in Switzerland, it's the same in Austria. And the utilization is even a little lower, less than 1.5 per average, in countries like the US or Canada. And also, their numbers tend to be slightly lower in Scandinavian countries. So 1.5 is already a good utilization. But overall, we have to understand that the motorized individual traffic, MIT, the motorized individual traffic with our private and owned cars is sort of the most inefficient way of mobility that we can think of. Because not only do we only use 1.5 seats on average in a car, when we use it, the car also sits around for about 23 hours on average for each day and is only driven one day. So for 23 hours, it requires a parking space, while for 1 hour, it is actually being used to perform any kind of transportation.
But are we comparing it pears and apples? Because, for example, I imagine the typical, we are talking about averages, but I imagine the typical mission of a car or the typical train journey and the typical plane journey, each fulfill a different niche in the travel ecosystem. Of course, you will have people traveling, let's say, from Paris to Berlin by train, few people, not many, compared to the plane. But you would have the majority of people doing, for example, you know, some regional travel on a train, and then you will have maybe quite a lot of people commuting with the car locally or regionally, and then the plane, using the plane for much longer distances.
You're right. They have different, you have different niches, but you still have the same issue when it comes to comparing these systems. And 1 person kilometer, 1 PKM of transport volume is 1 PKM. And the question is, how can we make this most efficient? And that is, in the end, what we have to do. If you want to really help the environment, we have to think about efficiency. And of course, there are ways of improving efficiency in all systems. And then we have to look at what is it being used for. For example, and I've looked into that into much more detail, utilizing cars differently, sharing cars and having mobility as a service platforms that would allow me to use a car whenever I need it, but I do not have to own the car and I do not have to have it sit around in my driveway for 23 hours every day in order to use it only one day. If we come up with solutions that help us to use that more efficiently, we can save enormous, enormous amounts of carbon dioxide. And on the other hand, cars need streets and they need highways and federal streets and all the rest of it. And that is a very, very carbon intense business. Same with railroads. The railroads need tracks, they need a lot of bridges, they need a lot of tunnels, they need for the same stretch, especially if it goes through a hilly or mountainous region. Trains need far more tunnels and bridges than cars need because they cannot cope with the same slope. They can only cope with rails that have a much lower slope than cars can utilize. And so here we have something which is very, very carbon intense. And that is also something I'd like to talk about in this podcast. Because once again, in aviation, we do not need anything of this path infrastructure. We can just use the air that is there, which does not mean that that everything is good with aviation and that we should be flying as much as we can, because the exhaust gases, especially if the kerosene is of fossil base, are an issue for the climate. But we always have to look at the different systems, and we have to see. Where can we improve the efficiency? And that is, as engineers and scientists, what we have to look at in order to perform better.
But looking at this argument, someone could tell you, for example, someone could say, well, yeah, but the roads and the railways, in principle, are already there, or you need them. I mean, you need to have the roads because there's a number of functions that would need to be fulfilled, even if it's through shared cars, emergency services, cargo, etc. Maybe this debate I mean, you will have this physical infrastructure, so there's a sort of carbon footprint that it's very difficult to avoid because you need it for a society to function. But maybe the key of the debate is on the incremental side. So when you are talking, when you need to invest additional money and resources to create new infrastructure, for example, to deviate traffic from aviation to railway, for example, and this requires new infrastructure to be built, new services, new rail cars that wouldn't be there if all this extra traffic stayed on the air. So how can we differentiate these two levels? So this base level, I think it happens something like that with power plants. You need to guarantee a base level and also a peak level. And then this imposes some burdens.
Yeah, very good point, Mikael. Very good point. You're right. Yes, you're right. But one thing you also have to keep in mind, whatever you do, even if it is basic infrastructure, the carbon dioxide that was emitted during construction has to be accounted for something. Because it is too easy, it's too simple to say this is what the industry does and we just have to improve that. Industry does a lot, but it has to be accounted for something. So if industry is building streets, the carbon dioxide emitted on that has to be counted on the traffic performance of the streets, of the road traffic. If they are building rails and tunnels and bridges for trains, the carbon dioxide emitted for that has to be accounted for on the mobility sector in railway traffic. And if airports are being built, that is the node infrastructure that has to be accounted for the carbon footprint and the respective person kilometers or ton kilometers in freight transport for the aviation industry. It's the same if they produce glass for window panes. They don't just produce the glass for the sake of producing glass. They sell it to someone, and then that has to be accounted for housing because we want to have windows to prevent us from the cold in the winter. And if we need electricity for many, many things, the production of power plants has to be calculated into the footprint of electricity providing. And that is the same, by the way, with solar panels and windmills. So we always have to look at the overall, the holistic impact, even in such systems. And I'm always getting a bit angry when people are speaking of zero emission or zero carbon electricity because it's from solar panels or because it's from windmills, because that is simply not correct. Even if you don't burn fuel, you have to produce the windmill. And every single windmill needs to be set up and it needs to be put onto a foundation with tons of concrete and steel, armored concrete, and photovoltaic elements, PV elements need to be manufactured somewhere. And that is also a very carbon intense process. So looking at the overall carbon footprint of energy, you of course have to take into account the carbon cost for setting up the infrastructure before you start producing electricity. Once again, this is the same mistake we're making, that we're not looking at the overall picture and the complete system. And I'm not saying that it is not good to have PV and it's not good to have windmills. All I'm saying is we should never be speaking of electricity that is carbon free. That simply does not exist. At least not now and not for the foreseeable future.
And well, you know, going back to aviation, as you know, right now there's a lot of pressure on the aviation industry. And one of the measures that are being pitched is ending or severely limiting short-haul flights, at least in Europe, in some parts of Europe, talking about trains as an alternative. What do you make of this? What is the, in your opinion, the position of aviation in relation to the railway system, at least in Europe? Let's focus on Europe, maybe, because it's one of the areas where maybe this comparison is more valid. Other parts of the world, maybe they don't have that facility to switch from one mode to another. So what do we make of this? Is the train really an alternative to the plane? Because I think you're a bit skeptical about this approach.
Yeah. First of all, of course, it's an alternative, but my point is that it is by no means as eco-friendly as it is usually said, because we have to look at the path infrastructure, which is extremely important for trains. And I'd like to give you a few numbers on this. The production of steel, which is iron pretty much, results in about 2 tons of carbon dioxide for each ton of steel. And that is only the process in the so-called coke plant and blast furnace. We have to look at that iron as a metal does not exist on this planet. It has to be produced from iron ore. And this iron ore to iron and then steel processing is extremely energy intense. And that require or that results in a lot of carbon dioxide, because these days we mainly use coal in order to for the energy in this process. It's very similar with aluminum, only worse. The production of 1 ton of aluminum, 1 ton of metal aluminum, results in 8 to 10 tons of carbon dioxide. Copper, for example, which is very important for everything that we want to do electrically, 1 ton of copper produces 6 tons of carbon dioxide in the production from the copper ore to the metallic copper. And that does not account for any kind of drilling wires and so on and so on. It's just the pure making of the metal. Another thing extremely carbon intense is cement. Also, for chemical reasons, I'm not going into the details of the chemistry right now, but you really have to understand basic chemistry in order to see why this is the case and why this is not changing so soon. For cement, about 1 ton of cement, which is an important ingredient in concrete, 1 ton of cement produces about 1 ton of carbon dioxide somewhere in the world. That is the important part, always somewhere in the world. It's not always where we use it, but with regard to the climate and the atmosphere, it absolutely does not make any difference where the carbon dioxide is produced, because CO2, which is released into the air, into the atmosphere, and not bound by anything else, these carbon dioxide molecules, they tend to be around for about 100 years. And so they evenly spread in the atmosphere, and it's absolutely irrelevant where that happens. This is also important to understand. Now, speaking about trains particularly, if you just look at the rails, I mean, never anyone picked up a rail just like that, because they are fixed to the slab track or into the to the gravel and or the concrete sleepers. But just a number, rails are very heavy. Steel is heavy. So 1 kilometer of rails, so that's two rails with a certain distance, 1 kilometer of rails is 120 tons of steel. And that is, as I just said, 240 tons of carbon dioxide just for the production of the steel. And an even more impressive example, if we have an electric train, we have this copper wire that is above the rail, and the trains take the electricity from there. The copper wire is only 120 square millimeters in cross diameter. But since copper is very heavy, 1 kilometer of copper live wire, as we call it, the live wire that the electricity runs through, is more than 1 ton of copper. And you need additional tons of steel and concrete and more stuff, aluminum and lots of other stuff, in order to put up the electrical grid for a railway for a railway track. Because you need masts every 65 meters that have to hold extreme heavy loads, and they have to be very sturdy. So they need huge amounts of concrete, of armored concrete as a foundation, so the masts won't fall down, and so on and so on. I've written a study, a survey on this, and also in English that can be downloaded, and or maybe you can even link it to the notes of this episode, but there you have all the detailed calculations. And just to give you a few general numbers, building 1 kilometer of double track high speed railroad, now we're talking of two tracks, not only one, I was talking of one, but 1 kilometer of double track high speed railroad is more than 1500 tons of carbon dioxide just for the materials being used. That does not include the building itself. And if we're going cross bridges, ferro concrete bridges as they are used today. Of course, it depends very much on how high is the bridge and how many pillars does it have and what is the underground soil and what foundation is needed. But there have been extensive surveys for bridges that were built over the last 15 years, and I took the average numbers of those. We're talking about close to 19,000 tons of carbon dioxide for 1 kilometer of double-track ferroconcrete railway bridge. And when it comes to tunnels, it's even getting worse because these days, every tunnel in Europe that is longer than 500 meters can only be a single line tunnel. So you need to have two separate tunnel tubes for each direction, as long as it is longer than 500 meters, and that is for security reasons. But we're talking in the range of 30,000 tons of carbon dioxide just for the emission, for the materials to build such tunnels when you need a two-tube tunnel for railroad lines.
Yeah. But and that's why earlier I mentioned the incremental investment compared to base infrastructure that it's in place. Okay, it's very expensive. Mm-hmm. It requires lots of resources. But once you've built it, is there? Mm-hmm. I mean, there's still some bridges and tunnels built in the 19th century, and they're still there. And of course, there's maintenance, but wouldn't the bulk of this investment be a one-off thing? And then it's relatively lighter in terms of resource requirements?
Unfortunately not. First and foremost, I want to state one important thing. Every infrastructure that we have, we should use as much and as good and as long as possible. Full stop. There is nothing to add to that. That is a very important point because we do not get a single gram of carbon dioxide back into any imaginary bottle just because we're not using an infrastructure that we've already built. But contrary to what many people like to propose, this, especially railroad infrastructure, is not built for eternity. It does not last forever. Speaking of the high-speed train tracks, which I just mentioned with some of the numbers, how much carbon emit when they're being built, they last for 30 years. We know that because in Germany, we have huge projects rebuilding the first generation of high-speed rail lines. And they had been around for 30 years, and 30 years is already a high number of average use when you have tens of trains large numbers of trains every day racing across these tracks. They have to be replaced after 30 years. And replacing them means new rails, new slab track, new electrification, and new control infrastructure. Bridges and tunnels last longer. The average is about 70 years. We see that. And that's the same, by the way, for car infrastructure, for road infrastructure. Many, many things in Germany were built after the Second World War, because in the war, almost everything was destroyed. So a lot of these things were built in the 1950s, 60s, and a lot still in the 1970s. And now we have 50, 60 years after that. And there are thousands of bridges in Germany that have to be rebuilt. Many of them are just blocked because they are not safe to be used anymore. They are blasted away, and it takes years to build new ones. So, as I said before, use everything that you have as long as you can, but think very, very carefully and calculate exactly. And that's important. You have to calculate this and do not guess. Gut feeling is not helpful in this. Calculate what do you really need for the future. And now when it comes to making these decisions, and we have big political and societal discussions going on in Germany, we should stop flying domestically. Like, don't fly from Hamburg to Munich, take the train. And besides the fact that you have immense infrastructure requirements for the trains to go from Hamburg to Munich and vice versa, or to any other place, Munich to Berlin or Hamburg to Zurich, doesn't really matter. You have immense infrastructure requirements. We also have to look at another aspect of mobility, and that is the physics of movement. You have to look at how energy efficient is it to move around, comparing a train and a plane in this place, or even a car. And the problem really is that a lot of this can be calculated, in detail, but it also requires a certain understanding of physics, of mathematics, and when it comes to building the infrastructure and the materials of chemistry, as I mentioned before. And that is not something that most people like to deal with, and this is why they prefer to follow their gut feeling and to follow their to discuss this more ideological and very emotionally rather than from a scientific and engineering perspective.
And have you calculated, for example, what could be the potential savings or absence of savings of, for example, diverting a certain percentage of traffic from aircraft to trains or from aircraft to other modes of transportation?
That is, I've done a lot of calculations, and it's a little difficult to explain all this in a podcast here without any slides and just talking about the numbers. I know how difficult this is.
Well,
But I need to do this. Yeah, we will
we
do
can
this. We will
try
do
put
this.
your presentation on the show notes for people that
We can put some slides there. That
yeah.
would certainly be possible. But I'll give you a few more examples for comparison, because I realize that when I give presentations, this is always something that people like, because they can compare this better. And I'll take one single engineering project, the Gotthard Base Tunnel, which is a train tunnel in Switzerland. And I want to admit, this is a fantastic engineering project. I mean, I always admire the people who are capable of building something. This is really absolutely fantastic. But what I've done together with colleagues from a university in Switzerland who also deal with mobility a lot, we've compared the traffic from Zurich, Switzerland to Milano in northern Italy. And we've compared the train, the road, and the aviation trip. For example, on this trip, you go through the Gotthard Base Tunnel, which is more than 50 kilometers long. It's the longest train tunnel in the world. Besides the Gotthard Tunnel, you have two other very large tunnels, the Ceneri and the Monte Olimpino, which are both longer than 10 kilometers. And you have dozens of smaller tunnels and many, many bridges. And this is because you're crossing the Alps. And of course, no country is at fault when it has a mountainous region. I mean, but it's not, you have to admit that the topography you have to deal with, it's there. You can't do anything about it. And looking and calculating the immense amounts of carbon dioxide that were emitted in order to build the train track and also the roads for the cars, which also have lots of tunnels, and compare that to aviation, it really comes out that flying from Zurich to Milan, taking everything into account holistically, is the least carbon intense mode of transportation. Now, of course, we have the Gotthard Tunnel. We have all the other tunnels. We have the bridges, and they are already there, so we have to continue to use them. My point is that if we are thinking about new high-speed rail lines in particular, and that is something that politicians in Europe are talking about all over, you have to calculate very, very carefully for two reasons. Now, a few more numbers about the Gotthard Base Tunnel. Many of the listeners of this podcast probably know the Eiffel Tower, or actually have been to Paris and have seen the Eiffel Tower. Monstrous tower, beautiful, 300 meters high, full of steel. The Eiffel Tower weighs about 10,100 tons. It's 10,100 tons of steel. And the amount of steel that was built in the Gotthard, or that was used for building the Gotthard Base Tunnel, would be sufficient to build 21 Eiffel Towers.
Wouldn't this be a bit of an extreme case? Because a big part of Europe, where most people live, actually, it's much flatter, and most people live along these very dense corridors. For example, northern and central Germany, the Netherlands, northern France.
Not really. It always looks like that. But I'll give you one other example that I have calculated as a project that I was asked to do the calculation for a new high-speed rail line, which is in northern Germany from Bielefeld to Hanover. And this is an area where we do not have many mountains or hills or anything like that. It's pretty flat. And the German railways, Deutsche Bahn, they are planning to build a new high-speed track. And for the high speeds, they need extremely straight rail lines, just drawn with a pencil pencil or with a biro on a map. And even for this region without any decent mountains, and there already exists, there is a train track already, which does not have any tunnels. But they are planning to build a new train track, and for 80 kilometers, that would require 20 kilometers of tunnel. So for 25%, even in a flat region, they want to build tunnels because they want to get the high-speed trains through there. And I'll give you another comparison in an area which is not the Alps. It is a so-called mid-mountainous region in Germany. It's from Cologne to Frankfurt. It was one of the first high-speed trains, train tracks that were built. It's been operative for more than 20 years now. It's 170 kilometers from Cologne to Frankfurt, and it goes pretty much parallel to the Autobahn, to the highway. The highway for the cars, the road, does not have any tunnels at all. And the train track has 47 kilometers of tunnel out of 170. So that is, once again, it's a lot of tunnels required for trains that go high speed. Yeah, so it's even when it is flat, and one thing that many people are not aware of, because there are so many smaller paths and there are streams and small rivers and so on. In Germany, on average, we have a bridge, a railway bridge, always after less than 2 kilometers of track.
Only 2 kilometers. So there's a bridge every 2 kilometers in average.
Oh, I think it's even 1.3 or 1.5. It's less. Yeah. But many of these bridges are very small. So you don't even realize that you're on a small bridge when you cross over it. Yeah. So the infrastructure, the point I'm trying to make is the infrastructure has enormous requirements, and it is extremely expensive, and it is extremely carbon intense to build it. And once again, for the future, and I'm talking about the future, we have to compare it with the infrastructure, the path infrastructure for aviation, which is zero, 0.0, and it will stay like. And this is why I'm talking about future mobility concepts rather than what will happen as of tomorrow. I'm personally often accused of being anti-rail travel and hating trains. This is complete bullshit. Excuse my words, but I want to make this very, very clear. Personally, I have used the trains in my life more than 1,500 times. So I've really been on trains a lot. And I still like to ride, to go on trains. It's convenient when it works, when they're on time. And you don't have to drive yourself, and you don't have to go through security compared to aviation. The point I'm trying to make is, it is by no means as eco-friendly as many, many people believe. And this is the result from intensive research that I've done. And this is why I say we have to think mobility differently when we speak about the future.
But what order of magnitude are we talking about? One of the examples you presented earlier, Munich to Milan, for example, what's the average impact of a passenger traveling between the two cities, traveling by train or by aircraft, what sort of differential or non-differential are we talking about here?
Well, we have to keep in mind that as long as we use fossil fuels, and that is almost all the calculations I've done, and for example, in a car, we have about 90 grams of carbon dioxide per person kilometer, per PKM, 90 grams. So if we go 100 kilometers, we produce 9 kilograms of carbon dioxide just by using our car. And that is with the average car and the average utilization. By plane, it is very similar with regard to the exhaust fumes, very similar. In a car, if we use an electric car, let me make that very clear. The important question is, what is the carbon footprint of the electricity generation? So how much carbon dioxide do we emit in order to produce 1 kilowatt hour of electricity? And that, for example, is very different in Germany compared to, let's say, France or Sweden or other Scandinavian countries. And that, of course, influences the footprint a lot. Yeah. And however, we also have to keep one other thing in mind, and that is how energy efficient is the travel process itself. And that is something I'd also like to address this topic briefly. It's what I call mechanical movement efficiency. And now I have to explain a little bit of basic physics. This is
Yeah, go for it.
physics 101. Every transportation process requires energy for certain physical things that happen. First, we need energy for acceleration. And the energy we need for the acceleration is dependent on the mass that we move, the mass, the weight actually in kilograms, and the speed that we gain. Then we need, have energy to overcome resistance, that is friction, but it is mainly the air drag. As a matter of fact, when you move faster than 80 kilometers per hour, the air drag or the energy that is required to overcome the air drag is so important that you can almost neglect any kind of friction that arises from your rubber wheels on the street or from the steel rails and the steel wheel of a train. So we can neglect those. We have to look at the energy to overcome the air drag. And then the third amount of energy, or the third energy thing we need, is the energy to overcome gravity. That is when we are moving uphill. And what I've learned in presentations and in lectures that I regularly give at a regional university here is that many people have the understanding that energy to overcome gravity is only required for aviation, because they see planes taking off from the ground and going up into the sky, and they say, of course, they have to overcome the gravity. But even if trains and cars always stay on the ground, they always have to cope with gravity whenever they go uphill. And that is what many people simply don't see. And the formula to calculate the amount of energy required to overcome gravity is exactly the same. It is determined by the mass that is being moved, the gravitational constant that we have on this planet, and by the altitude. So if you want to move up a mass of 100 kilos and you want to go up 1,000 meters, it's 100 multiplied by 9.81 multiplied by 100, and then you have a number in joule, and that is the energy that is required.
We'll
So
try to
it's
put these formulas in the show notes so
yes,
that
yeah, we can, yeah,
people
exactly. So I'm, yeah, I
can
will not
follow
go
that.
into that in more detail, but this is the basics that you have to look at. And then the energy efficiency of a movement process is determined by the total mass to be moved, then by the number of acceleration processes to be performed, and the speed that you accelerate to, and the elevation to be overcome. That's very simple. We know this since Sir Isaac Newton. He came up with the laws of mechanics, and all that is derived from that. And what we can also say is that the more uniform the movement is, and the fewer accelerations and decelerations we have, the more efficient the transportation process is. So the bottom line can be traffic must flow. If you stop cars deliberately at every single traffic light, what some politicians do, they think they do something in favor of the environment, but it's exactly the opposite. The more stops you have, the fewer efficient, or the less efficient the process is. And then we have to look at what masses are we moving around. So trains are very heavy. An empty ICE train, the Intercity Express train that we have in Germany, has a mass of over 400 tons, empty. So that means in the average utilized train, the average utilization rate around 55, 56%, we move around 1.7 tons of train weight for each passenger.
1.7 tons per passenger.
1.7 ton per passenger. If we use the ICE3 train, which I used for my calculations, which is a widely used train in Germany, and we use the average utilization rate of about, I think it was 55.6% or
And
something like that. So
that's a moving material. So that's the rail
that is the
cars,
moving
the
material.
locomotive.
Yes, exactly. It's the whole train. Actually, the ICE trains, they do not have a single locomotive. They have I think the one train has about eight parts where engines run and accelerate the train. It's not
Oh,
a single
okay.
locomotive. Yeah, so
So it's
it's these
distributed.
trains,
Okay.
they are very, very sophisticated. It's different in freight trains again. So there you only have one or sometimes two locomotives, but that is just the way it is. But anyway, you move around 1.7 tons of material per passenger. In a car, it is also pretty disastrous because the average utilized car has a weight of 1.5 tons, empty weight, and that is going up because cars are so the SUV, many SUVs, they are way above 2 tons. If they are fully electric, because the batteries also tend to be very heavy, you sometimes move around 2.5 tons of car. And then imagine one person or one and a half on average, or even two persons sitting in there. You're moving around huge masses, and that is important for the energy required for acceleration and for gravity, and so on and so on. So, once again, back to the average. Utilizing an average car by 1.5 people, you move around 1 ton of car for each of the passengers. And then, of course, in a car and in a plane, you also have to take the energy that drives your vehicle with you. So that is important. You have to put gas in the tank, and gas is not as heavy as water, it's lighter, but it still needs to be moved around. That, and especially in a plane, becomes important because you very
Yes.
often have tons of kerosene in the fuel tanks. Anyway, looking at a plane, and for my calculations, I took the largest plane that we have for domestic travel in Germany. That's the Airbus A321, and looked at the average looked at the empty weight and the average utilization. In this case, Lufthansa in the year 2019, I think it was around 82%, and then plus the kerosene per passenger that is on average in the tank. Once again, a lot of average here because you don't fill up the tanks completely to fly from Hamburg to Munich. But so on average, we have 57 kilograms of kerosene per passenger. And then we have an overall mass to be moved in a plane of about 450 kilograms, including the passenger. In the train, we had 1.7 tons of train weight plus 100 kilograms for the passenger. We always calculate 100 kilograms per person, and that includes the luggage.
Yeah, I was about to say
So,
that would assume
it includes the
a
luggage.
bit
These
of
are
an
airline
obesity
trains.
problem,
Yeah, this
but
is now, I know if I travel with my wife, we're good. If I travel by myself, I'm overweight. But on average,
okay.
this works. So, this is a number that I did not invent. It's something that traffic scientists always consider a person to be 100 kilograms. So, on a train, we have 1.8 tons of mass to be moved around. It's 1700 kilograms of train weight and 100 kilograms of person. And in a car, it's a little bit more than 1.1 tons. It's including the kerosene. On a plane, it's about 450 kilograms of plane weight, passenger weight, and kerosene. So we have only a quarter of the mass to be moved around in an average loaded A321 compared to the average train. A quarter of the mass. And now remember, the mass was important for the energy consumption, both for accelerations and for overcoming gravity, the so-called lifting power that is required. Now, if you go by train, the train stops on its way from Hamburg to Zurich. It has 14 stops. At least that's the fastest train. Hamburg to Zurich, in this case, Hamburg to Munich, it has 8 intermediate stops. That means you have not only one acceleration process, but you have nine acceleration processes, at least nine acceleration processes on the way to Munich, or 15 on the way from Hamburg to Zurich. And these are only the accelerations from 0 to the max speed of that stretch, which is about 270 kilometers, sometimes 290, sometimes 250. There are also many more acceleration processes between the train stations because the train cannot always go at maximum speed. There are certain parts of the track where a lower speed is required. It has to do with the radius of curves and so on. It's a complicated thing to look at in detail, but we have to keep in mind it has many more acceleration processes of a much higher mass, 4 times the mass compared to a plane. So that means that although the plane accelerates to a much higher speed in the end, but only once, the overall energy required just for the acceleration for a train per passenger on its way from Hamburg to Munich or on its way from Hamburg to Zurich is much more than the energy required for one acceleration of only a quarter of the mass, but to a higher speed, but that only happens once. And this is an interesting perspective of looking, because this is these kind of theoretical calculations based on physical formulas, they determine the limits of how efficient we can get. That is a very important thing for looking at mobility systems of the future. Other than just looking at the overall masses to be moved and the acceleration energy and energy required for the movement process, one important aspect also is that we got to look at the overall distance to be covered for a journey from A to B. So getting back to the example for, let's say, Hamburg to Zurich, the distance by train is considerably longer than the distance by plane. And the same is true for Hamburg to Munich or Munich to Berlin. So we can say that on average, for the distances and the destinations I've looked at, the train travel is between 30 and 35% longer than the distance as the crow flies, as we usually say. Now, we have to keep in mind that planes also sometimes have to deviate from the shortest distance because of departure routing and arrival routing into or out of airports, into airports, but we still see a smaller distance to be covered by the plane compared to the train and also compared to road travel. And I think I mentioned before that with all transportation and mobility systems, there's always room for improvement. And in particular in Europe, the distance between airports could be improved or could be shortened if we finally would come to the Single European Sky Agreement that would definitely allow shorter distances to be flown between two airports. So this is an important aspect where improvement, especially for European air travel, still could be seen. And I think it is important that politicians and the different air traffic control authorities finally come to conclusions here, which would optimize the travel further.
So putting all this together, in summary, what would be in the hypothetic case where we were looking at the person traveling in Germany, for example, or between Munich and Milan, for example, what would be the ultimate result with the caveat that all these are averages? Of course, it's based on hypotheses, parameters that we need to define some base case. What would be the difference between the impact of each of these modes of transportation?
Yeah, it is, of course, every individual case is very different. The general statement that I like to make is that we have to look at mobility in a completely different way. We have to think mobility differently, actually, compared to what we're doing right now. The very simple statements that usually state rail travel is eco-friendly and driving is harmful and flying is should be covered with shame, or people should be ashamed if they fly, that is definitely not correct. My overall perception is, with regard to infrastructure, use the infrastructure we have, be very, very cautious and careful, and calculate very, very exactly, and do not guess when it comes to rebuilding or building new infrastructure. And over the long run, the fact that aviation does not need any path infrastructure at all, and will never need any path infrastructure at all, aviation will become even more efficient. And from the moment where we can get the drive energy, the kerosene, if we can get that carbon neutral or CO2 free or anything like that, or if we get much better with that, then aviation will be by far the most efficient and the most eco-friendly way of transportation. And of course, a lot needs to be done, but there is a big discussion going on about sustainable aviation fuels. And once we will have sufficient amounts of sustainable aviation fuels, aviation will win even further compared to land-based travel systems because it does not need the path infrastructure.
One point, though, is when we talk about infrastructure, are we counting also the infrastructure that aircraft require? Because we are seeing all these massive airport projects. They require lots of steel and concrete and all sorts of building materials there as well, plus all the access infrastructure and all the auxiliary services built around it. So is that included in the calculations?
Yes, of course, that is another aspect. That is what I call for the node infrastructure. And we have this node infrastructure for every mobility system or transportation system as well. We're speaking of airports, huge airports, that's right, for aviation, but we also have all the train stations for rail travel, and we need all the parking lots and parking garages for road travel. And everything else, or everything, also the airports, they need to be looked at. What is the footprint and what is the transportation volume that we get from the node infrastructure? So when we look at airports, and we have to compare that with train stations. And in Germany alone, the rail network has 5,500 train stations. Not all of them are huge or big, but many of them are. So, for example, train stations where ICE, the Intercity Express trains, stop, they need to have platforms which are more than 400 meters long. And we have 400 meters of massive concrete constructions just for the platforms. And that is enormous amounts of carbon dioxide to build them and to refurbish them. What's happening? To give you one example, which I consider a sheer disaster project, is that for many, many years in Germany, they're currently building the train station for the Stuttgart main station, Stuttgart 21, it's called. They are putting that train station that is still above the ground, they're putting the whole train station 30 meters below the ground. And I mean, that's a project which not only costs anywhere between 10 and 11 billion euros, and these are the numbers we're seeing right now because they're still building it. The project is delayed for many, many years. Original plans saw it at a range of 3.5 to 5 billion, so we have doubled or tripled the price. But another institute has already calculated the carbon emissions. Just lowering that train station or digging the train station into the earth 30 meters underground is more than 2 million tons of carbon dioxide just in the materials, in particular concrete and steel, for all the tunnel tubes they're building. So we have enormous, enormous infrastructure costs also for the railway node infrastructure, which are stations. We have enormous amounts of money to spend on that. And one thing which is very important when we look at the ecological footprint of travel, we always also have to look at the economical footprint. What does it cost to provide one person kilometer of travel? Or what does it cost to provide 1 ton kilometer when we're talking freight? And who is paying for that? So we haven't discussed that in this podcast at all. That would be a complete story for another podcast if you like to do that. But
Yeah.
from an ecological point of view, the node infrastructure is just as important. I didn't cover that as much as I did cover the path infrastructure today. But of course, it needs to be looked at. And I can assure you that looking at the node infrastructure, the eco balance or the ecological footprint for train travel does not become better. It gets worse because everything has to be put into perspective with the travel volume, and that is measured in person kilometers. And that is enormous, just maintaining and keeping for Germany alone 5,500 train stations.
Well, I guess, and there's the opportunity cost as well of the resources. You could, I don't know, build a a solar power plant or something else with that, a SAF plant maybe, because it looks like there's going to be a bit of a scarcity as well of SAF.
Yes. Well, SAF is an important issue for aviation. I believe that we definitely have to put much more effort on doing research with regard to that. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that the numbers are probably known. The estimates for SAF for the future, there are numbers by the International Air Transport Association, IATA, and the estimates are for 2050 in the range of 360 million tons of SAF. And all the projects we're currently working on are in the double-digit thousands or maybe three-digit thousand tons. So the amount of SAF that, according to IATA, to estimations or estimates are necessary for the future are about 1,500 times as much as we had available in 2022. 1,500 times. Frankly, I do not see where that is coming from yet. Yeah, there is a lot to do, a lot of research to be done. And the other point is that with SAF, SAF is a very, very broad term. There are all kinds of different activities going on. You can look at the HEFA SAFs, the hydroprocessed esters and fatty acids. Then we have the vegetable oil pre-used in deep fryer pans. They're so-called the HVO, hydroprocessed vegetable oil SAF. We always have to look at what way is possible to kind of get CO2, carbon dioxide, from the atmosphere and use chemical processes in order to produce kerosene, hydrocarbons from there. Once again, that would be a subject that could easily fill a podcast in its own. I don't think we have the time today to elaborate on that in more detail.
Indeed, yeah, we should note it down and put it in the agenda for sometime in the future to keep talking about that, because it's very interesting to I really like this approach with numbers and back with some specifics. So it's not just vague talk about things, but actually I'm sure some people that are listening might not agree, some others would agree, but at least you have made your case with specific numbers and some tangible, well, tangible, some concrete figures to discuss. I'm not sure, did you take into account in your calculation as well other type of going back to now chemistry again, but other types of emissions that are not carbon? Or that would be a, yeah.
That once again, that's again a very complete topic, a very big topic for that would be sufficient for a whole podcast. I'm fully aware that other than carbon, there are at least 11 other aspects with regard to aviation in the atmosphere. A lot of research is going on there. There are very interesting papers, exactly by the same group of people, atmosphere scientists, mainly physicists, on usually led by Professor Lee from the UK. They also write the reports for the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change. So, whoever is interested, as I would strongly suggest, people who are interested to read these papers. They are published. They are openly available. I'd like to give a little bit of caution. In order to read these papers, you have to have a really much deeper understanding of physics. So this some parts of their hardcore physics, you have to be really acquainted with these things. And also you need to have some chemical knowledge because a lot of what happens in the atmosphere is atmospheric chemistry. And but I'm not trying to neglect these aspects. For example, the issue about contrails is a big issue with regard to warming and with regard to having an atmospheric or a climate impact from aviation. I know there are research projects going on whether by changing the altitudes of flights being performed can have an influence on whether they produce contrails or not. And I am aware of projects that have been going on with the German Air Traffic Control, the DFS, and the DLR, a research organization in Germany, to look at these things. I know that one of the Lufthansa planes has equipment on board in order to make measurements, to deliver scientific data. So a lot is going there as well. I'd be happy to discuss that with you once and also in a separate talk. But right now I have focused on carbon dioxide because everyone focuses on carbon dioxide. And overall, CO2 is the is or has the biggest impact on the climate of all the different impacts that we have. Although there are, even when it comes to gaseous impacts, there are others like methane or also the laughing gas. Individually, they have, or if you look at the single molecule, they have a much larger impact on the global warming than carbon dioxide. But for the mass, it's carbon dioxide altogether because it's just so much that is being emitted. And this is why I've been focusing on that. Everyone looks at it as the most important aspect on climate change. And this is why I focused on that first. But I have looked at the other things as well.
Oh, fair enough. Well, thank you so much. We're running out of time today.
Yeah. What I would like to do is, if I may, I would like to give like a short wrap up, how I usually wrap up my presentations, because these are just like some bottom lines that I'd like people to understand. And the first one is think holistically when assessing carbon dioxide and other environmental aspects, and never forget the necessary infrastructure for all the different mobility systems. And then very important is please calculate, do the math, and do not guess. I always say utilize the already existing infrastructure as good and as long as you can, but check carefully whether more infrastructure is really required in the long term. Then science and engineering must be the key for future mobility solutions. Ideology and emotions are simply not helpful. They don't help. Economic criteria must be considered just as holistically as ecologic criteria. What does it cost to provide 1 PKM of transportation? Who is paying for it? That is very important. Is the one who gets the benefit from the transportation also paying for it, or is the general public paying for it? Very, very important question. And then maybe the most important and my last statement in this podcast will be, scientific and economic laws do not care whether they are understood. They apply always and everywhere, even to those who do not understand them. And we have to keep that in mind.
Well, thank you very much. That was a really, really comprehensive summary of everything that we've been discussing, and a luxury for our audience to have you here, because that's the sort of insights that you normally share with top executives and other people that are looking into these matters at a high level at your conferences and presentations. So thank you again. Thank you so much for your time today. And we have, as we discussed, we should come up with another time to continue exploring the other nuances of this debate. So,
Would be my pleasure, Miguel. Thank you very much for having me.
one last thing I'm going to ask you is, where should people check or look for more information about all these things that you have been telling us? Is there a website where they can find some of your work?
There is a website, and I will provide you with a link for the show notes. I do admit that a lot of the published papers or papers that I published are in German, but some are in English. And what I also do, I kind of regularly publish and also very much in English on LinkedIn. And so you find me on LinkedIn by just searching for my name, Klaus Radermacher. And there you will find many documents I've written and articles I have written. And I will provide you with certain links that you can put them in the show notes of this episode.
Excellent. Let's do that then. Thank you so much again, and hopefully speak soon.
My pleasure, and I'm very much looking forward to speaking to you soon.
If you like this podcast, you can support us by giving it a great rating on Apple, Spotify, or whichever platform you get it from. And remember, you can, of course, subscribe to it. And you can also get regular updates through the Allplane website. That's allplane.tv. We have a newsletter where we cover the aviation industry every week with a special focus on innovation and sustainability. So give it a go. Thank you and goodbye.